Disruption Zone. Opportunity lives where the status quo dies. Talking to the greatest innovators, disruptors, and off-the-wall inventors we can scrounge up. You laugh, you'll learn, you'll be inspired. Now, here are your hosts, Leland Conway and Cameron Mills.
All right, it is the Disruption Zone, and I'm excited to be joined by one of my favorite guests of all time, Dr. Jeff Meldrum. He is a PhD and a professor of anatomy and anthropology at Idaho State University in Pocatello, Idaho. Is that right? It's Pocatello, right?
That's correct.
Mm-hmm. That's a really pretty area. It's south of Idaho Falls, just north of the Utah border. Am I getting my geography correct? Because I remember driving through there last year, and it was gorgeous.
That's right, yeah. It has a different sort of beauty. It's right on the edge of this sagebrush steppe, and so it's for those that like that kind of country, it's great. My home backs up right to the open foothills there, and that are cedar and sage covered, and it's wonderful. Yeah,
how about that? It's beautiful. So you're an anthropologist, I guess, by trade, so to speak, and you are a detective of sorts, right? I mean, is that the best way to describe what you do, kind of a historical detective?
Well, sure. I think all science is a kind of a detective work undertaking. I mean, when you have a hypothesis and then you begin to look for clues that either refute or confirm your hypothesis, and so I think most scientists have a little detective in heart.
The first time I saw you was on, I forget the name of the show, but it was on one of the, maybe Discovery Channel or History Channel, but there was a panel of scientists. You were one of them, and you were kind of diving into the evidence for Bigfoot, the evidence for a Sasquatch or a Yeti. And you were probably, I would say, maybe the most open-minded of the scientists in terms of where you have seen the evidence take you. Is that the best way to describe you? I mean, would you say that you believe there's such a thing, or would you say that you're open-minded and the evidence points towards, or how would you class that?
More the latter. I try to avoid that label of believer,
right?
Because it's so loaded with baggage. It's a moniker that ideological skeptics like to tag on to people in order to, call their credibility into question. Because, when you believe, the connotation is you've accepted something in the absence of evidence.
Mm-hmm.
You have
right.
You hold a conviction based on opinion or just a feeling, And so I argue that belief has nothing to do with it. It's all about the evidence.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm convinced by the evidence. I even have a T-shirt that someone gave me that had a frame from the Patterson-Gimlin film, and underneath it said "Believing since 1967." and I took a Sharpie and I crossed it out and I wrote over the top of it "Convinced since 1967."
That's terrific. I love that. We can speak of that in terms of faith. I'm a Christian. And I also am fascinated by science, and I don't believe the two are incompatible. And so when you were talking about belief is in the absence, like there's evidence, but not what I would call conclusive evidence. And that's the whole mystery of faith, right? So as a Christian.
Well, exactly.
Yeah. But then there's also things that are established in the sense that there's a strong amount of evidence and we can pretty well say this or that, right?
Right, exactly. And you're right. I'm like you. I am also a believing person. And for me, religious or spiritual faith is still a dynamic principle. Faith is the evidence of things not seen.
Perfect.
And it's that evidence that comes to bear, whether it's in your convictions about religious questions or whether it's about scientific questions. I mean, ultimately it's the proof is in the pudding. It's in the data. Again, with going back to Christian, to any spirituality,
right?
The proof is in the pudding. The fruits of your actions bear witness to the the legitimacy, the truthfulness of a principle, a guiding principle in your life. And in science, it should be the same way. Our conclusions should be evidence-driven.
Yeah. Do you think science has an issue right now in some ways across its spectrum where, you know, there's a tendency for corporations to get too deeply involved in the funding of science that can sometimes get in the way of really seeking that truth, or what?
Well, it can. In this discipline of anthropology, that's rarely the case. What we see more often than not, though, is that, you know, personal egos or career aspirations sometimes may cloud judgments, conclusions. Right. In other words, instead of looking for that evidence to falsify a hypothesis, which is the philosophical approach to gaining knowledge in science, the process of falsification, it's impossible to find all the positives to prove your point. But if you can demonstrate just one exception, then you're forced to reevaluate your hypothesis and refine it.
Right.
So it's more practical to proceed by falsification. And that's what drives, you know, the often misused principle of parsimony. Another pet peeve of mine is the misapplication of that Occam's razor, where it's misstated that the simplest explanation is most likely to be true. That's not what Occam said. He said, you know, that acknowledging this principle of falsification or this practice of falsification, that it makes most sense to start with the simplest explanation before, you know, you're not justified to jump to a more complex until you have first falsified the simplest, because that's the orderly way to systematically approach your question. To start with the simplest explanation, if you can knock the legs out, then you elaborate and then try to knock the legs out from under that. It doesn't say that the simplest is more likely to be true. In fact, history has shown us that oftentimes answers are very complicated, very unexpected. You know, and that's the problem with science today, or with scientists. And we should make a distinction there. I mean, there's the institution, and then there are the practitioners. And as with any institution, sometimes the ideals of the institution are not lived up to by its practitioners,
and
in religion as well. And so it's when you get attitudes like I've encountered with this topic, they can't exist, therefore they don't.
Right.
You adopt a preconception, a closed-minded, narrow-minded preconception of what can or cannot exist, and if what is presented is contrary to that, then it must be wrong.
Right.
And literally, that statement to me was followed up with, it doesn't matter what evidence he thinks he has.
You know, you're talking about that, and since we both share faith, I think I can bring this up. I think it'd be interesting. There was a documentary I watched called Patterns of Evidence about Exodus, and it kind of goes along with what you're saying. What this guy discovered, he was a media guy who had a kind of a crisis of faith, and he was like, well, if the Exodus didn't happen in the Bible, then none of it makes sense, right? It's all a big lie. So he goes to try to discover it, and what he discovered was, through talking to various different scientists, that there was an enormous amount of evidence of an Israelite nation of sorts, a Semitic nation, living in Egypt. And I don't want to go too far down the weeds here, but it was just interesting. And they even found evidence of a house that really seemed to fit the pattern of Joseph. The problem was it was about 150 to 200 years earlier than the quote-unquote accepted biblical timeline. And so all the archaeologists were dismissing it because even though the evidence existed, even for Jericho, it was the same thing, it existed slightly too early, and no one ever thought, maybe the timeline's off by a couple hundred years. Now, I'm not expecting you to comment on truth or validity of that, but I mean, it's kind of the same point, though, that you're making, that sometimes we discover things where we were looking at the evidence, and the evidence was there, and we didn't realize the evidence was there, right? It was just, we didn't piece it together. We weren't thinking about it in that more broad spectrum of, well, we got to eliminate the impossible, as Sherlock Holmes says, and then whatever's left, however improbable, must be the truth, right?
Right, exactly. That's very true. And so often our assumptions, and we think we know something, whether it's a strict literal chronology as taken from this particular text, or whether it's a preconception about the pattern and timing of human evolutionary events and current status of species, that we become kind of blinded to the possibility that, hey, maybe those things aren't so written in stone,
right?
You know, by the finger of God, that they're more they have cultural overtones or interpretations, or you know, maybe the people before the flood didn't live to be 900 years old, but that represents a collapsed chronology of patriarchs. That, you know, it's a shorthand for you know, for people with limited memories, for one thing.
That's a great point. One of the most powerful tools for anyone who's having a crisis of faith. I don't mean to take this into a religious discussion, but because I want to get into the other stuff. But one of the most powerful tools I ever found for that is the archaeological Bible, in which they discuss exactly what you just said, that a lot of what was written is, it's not that it's not literal, it's that, and it's not that it's not historical, it's that it was written in a sort of historical cultural shorthand that we have to, we have to be able to filter through that lens in order to see. Because there's so many things you look at it and you go, what does that mean? Right. You know, so, which it's fascinating stuff. And I'm sure that kind of drives you in terms of anthropology, because what is that? The study of humankind or people or beings? I mean, is that, how do I describe that? How do I describe anthropology?
Well, and I have to say, I'm, you know, you introduced me as an anthropologist. My degree is primarily in anatomy.
Okay.
So I'm more in the natural sciences than I am in the social sciences.
Yeah.
My dabbling or my wandering into anthropology was as a physical anthropologist from a fairly limited extent of paleoanthropology and primatology, and so I have not been trained up in the classical disciplines of anthropology, and there's a lot of especially on the social sciences side, there's a lot of philosophy and
it's true.
Different approaches to interpreting those. I don't want to say softer science, because that has the wrong connotation, but things that are a little more subjective,
right,
in the interpretation of the researcher than sticking a pair of calipers on a bone and taking a very objective measurement.
Yeah. So let's dive into sort of the idea of Bigfoot, Sasquatch, Yeti, you know, all this stuff. And it's mm-hmm. this lore that has attracted us for decades. And what's interesting about this, my wife is very skeptical, right? She's very, everything in the world is very black and white. For me, I'm more the philosophical what if guy. That wants to follow the trails of evidence and kind of piece together. And I love this stuff, right? Like, I dive into it. I consider myself an open-minded skeptic, meaning that, you know, I'm not, like you said, I'm not a believer, but I could be convinced if the evidence shows, right? So diving into that, I was trying to tell my wife the other day, I was making an explanation. I was saying, look, here's the deal. Almost every single indigenous people has a legend of some sort in their historical teachings about a being much like a Bigfoot. And she was like, really? I was like, yeah, these go back thousands of years. There's something out there, right?
Mm-hmm. That's what I would think. Yes. I mean, there's two sides of the fence to come down on when you make that, dangle that question out there. And there are those that would argue that, well, if it is so universal, if it is, you know, regardless of ecology or biology or whatever, if it's universal, then it must have something else, some other basis, some element of the human psyche. Mm-hmm. And so some have pointed to this as being some archetype of a mental construct that links us to our more animalistic forebear, maybe, or links us to the wilderness, where hairiness denotes uncivilized status or nature. I don't find that it is absolutely universal. I mean, you don't find the people who inhabit the Sahara, you know, the margins of the Sahara Desert, talking about wild hair, at least not to my knowledge,
right.
You know, wild, hairy, ape-like creatures.
Good point.
But it always, in most cases, it's the wild man of the woods.
Right.
There seems to be this ecological link to a particular type of habitat. And so, you know, on the other side of the fence, I would argue that there's something that has deep, deep historical or prehistorical roots that that suggests a species or multiple species, I would argue, that have been pushed to the fringes of habitable regions, in this case, the forests and mountains and even in some areas, you know, the deep river bottoms and swamps and so forth, that that represents a non-human hominoid, human-like creature, or in a taxonomic sense, a member of the superfamily Hominoidea. I mean, that can be taken, that term is used and can be taken in two ways, in a more colloquial sense, which just means hominoid, human-like, or a member of the superfamily Hominoidea, which are human-like beings, i.e. the apes and humans and our immediate ancestors, since the divergence with a shared common ancestor. And so the question is, you know, could there be something to that? Now, the fact that it has presence even in cultures at a time when there wasn't a modern sensibility of our evolutionary legacy, I find really fascinating. I mean, and this is something that has only really come into focus in the past, oh, three or four decades, half century at most. That is, we now have a context, I mean, really since the 60s and 70s, when we have a context, a notion of a bushy family tree that was populated with multiple lineages of human-like, ape-like creatures. And the fact that as our understanding of that phylogeny grows, we recognize the persistence of many of those branches until much more recently than was ever thought likely in the past. So, you know, you have what really drove that message home, in my opinion, was the discovery of the Hobbit, Homo floresiensis.
Oh, yeah. That was fairly recent, wasn't it?
Yeah, you know, it was initially announced somewhere between 13,000 and 18,000 years. Now that's been pushed back a little bit as the stratigraphy of the cave has been worked out better. So, but to 50,000 years, but still, you have a 50,000-year-old creature that essentially looks like a Homo habilis, which otherwise we would have thought was restricted to East Africa, you know, 2 million years ago. And so there's a bunch of chapters of the book missing, obviously,
between
East Africa 2 million years ago and Southeast Asia 50,000 years ago. So there's a lot of the story we don't know, but the more we keep adding to it, the more it begs the question of, are we the only hominid species still on the planet, as so many have suggested? I mean, it's been sort of the party line, the consensus statement that we are the last hominin standing, as it was used as in the title of a recent documentary. And so now, but yet in the face of the growing evidence, now the context for such stories as Sasquatch and Oreng Pendek and Russian Almas, the Chinese Yeren. I mean, like you said, all these different cultures that have a remarkable congruence to the distribution, past and present habitats, potential habitats for such creatures. I mean, it's just uncanny that the native, the indigenous populations in Russia talk about, and some of those countries like Tajikistan and that area around Mongolia to the site to the west of Mongolia, describe a creature that remarkably fits the profile of a Neanderthal in the very areas where we know Neanderthals did exist based on their paleontological and archaeological record.
Fascinating.
And yet, you know, these people would have no knowledge of that.
Right. So and so the number one pushback I always get from people is, well, then why haven't we found one alive, or why haven't we found a body?
Exactly. Right. Well, and again, I mean, we wouldn't be talking about this subject the way we are if it had been. I mean, there are parallel examples of subsequent discoveries where if you wound the clock back a few decades, you'd be having the exact same question posed. I mean, when stories of the gorilla were described, the same retort, the same pushback, I'm sure, was encountered by those. Oh, you know, if there was such a thing out there, we would have seen it. We would have found it.
Right.
You know, there's nothing left to be discovered.
Just for context, so how long ago did we discover quote-unquote gorillas?
Well, the Highland gorilla was in the early 1900s. The lowland was known through the late 1800s. So,
but we're talking the last 200 years that we even knew these animals existed. And they're huge animals.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. Because they're rather retreating. In the case of the mountain gorilla, they're very few in number. You know, they occupy very remote areas that are not frequented by humans, except enough to occasionally bump into them. So it's a similar kind of thing. I mean, it's sort of remarkable when you look at the history of the discovery of the gorilla and even the evolution of the perception of it as a species, you know, from the monster Barnum and Bailey billing the gorilla gargantuan as the most terrifying creature on the face of the earth.
King
and then
Kong.
We have, you know, we go from that to Coco the gorilla picking out her next kitten, you know, and talking about it.
Right.
So quite a change in our attitude and our understanding of the nature of the creature. And I think the same kind of thing, if you just stick Sasquatch in, substitute it for the term gorilla, the story sounds remarkably familiar.
Well, and isn't the evidence that we have showing us that this is even more closely related to us, meaning it's probably shades and levels more intelligent?
It could well be. I think that, we have kind of competing hypotheses. There are some who point to a known giant ape, Gigantopithecus, that was, as I've pointed out repeatedly, it's the right size in the right place at the right time. And it could easily have extended its range into North America. I mean, its fossils are found in areas where there are reports of the Yeren, which for all intents and purposes is essentially the same as the Sasquatch. Mm-hmm. I think they are the same, if not the same species, then, you know, sibling species, since their separation across the Pacific. But
would it be that they crossed the land bridge just as people did?
Exactly.
That's how we populated part of America?
Right. And not only us, but 75% of the mammals that we think are native to North America actually originated in Asia and came across that land bridge as it existed at various times.
Right.
And people have, you know, on that note, just to add, because there still are people who labor under the misconception, even some accomplished authors who depict that land bridge as a frozen Arctic wasteland. Mm-hmm. You know, that animals that made it had to brave this tundra like environment. And that's just not true. It was true at some points of history, but there were also times when it was blanketed with a thick, verdant forest habitat, even a mixed deciduous coniferous forest habitat. And so it's not like when you think of animals coming into North America, you don't have to think about them purposely marching towards some unknown destination across the eastern horizon. They're simply expanding their range through available habitat,
right,
as it presents itself.
Same as a bear does. I mean, the bear's pouring into eastern Kentucky now, and now, you know, there's having to be a control put on that population. It's the same thing. They're just expanding where the habitat is feasible for them.
That's right. You know, and I like to point out to people, too, for example, most people are familiar with the little red panda, the little raccoon-looking panda,
right.
You know, size of a small dog, and yet we have fossils of it in North America. There's teeth in, that have been recovered in Washington State and even down in the South, the eastern, southeastern part of the United States. And so if a little panda, a little raccoon-sized mammal can make it across that land bridge, from Asia into North America, why would not why would it be unexpected for so many other species, including a bipedal ape moving through a very similar habitat? You know, Gigantopithecus shared a similar habitat with the red panda in Asia.
Yeah, fascinating.
So
when you say convinced versus believe, what is the evidence that you have seen as a scientist that convinces you the most that there's a really strong possibility this thing exists?
Well, as a scientist, the evidence that drew me in professionally into, you know, beyond just a personal interest in it from that goes way back to my youth, it was the footprints. My research expertise as an anatomist / physical anthropologist is the evolution of human bipedalism. And so I'm very familiar with the adaptations of the lower extremity, especially for walking on 2 feet. And, one of my first experiences was being shown a long line of tracks in southeastern Washington State by Paul Freeman, who had discovered them just that morning. It was in the spring, in February. There had been a early melt off of some of the snow, and these tracks appeared on a farming access road, very muddy, and so long line of tracks, not just a single isolated imprint, that could be ambiguous, but these were pristine, clear tracks in fresh mud that were so fresh. I mean, hours at the most, that they still exhibited skin ridge detail in some of the footprints. But unfortunately, it was a wet, drizzly day, which was, well, unfortunate for the mud was there for the tracks to be so well preserved, but the weather conditions also then obliterated those finer trace details before I was able to
preserve them. But as an anthropologist, you're able to tell the difference between somebody who, like the old TV shows, just straps on a pair of big Bigfoot costume shoes and walks a distance. You can tell the difference between those, right?
Well, I would like to think so, yes. And I think there are criteria. You know, it's kind of once never says never. Dr. Krantz got himself in a little bit of trouble when he was a little too cavalier in some instances. And there were people who actually, you know, laid traps for him, snares for him, and hoaxed some evidence. But I think I've shown a couple of times there was a funny experience with Les Stroud and his Survivor Man Bigfoot when he came to my lab and brought a couple of footprints that were really quite intriguing looking. I was very interested in them, but there was, you know, some red flags immediately went off. I was trying to be polite, but yet I was being cautious, and it just so happened that there were some remarkable similarities to one very well-known and very clear and crisp footprint taken from Grays Harbor, up in Grays Harbor County, Washington State, by an on-duty deputy sheriff by the name of Dennis Hereford. And I just happened to have a copy of one of those tracks handy and reached over and pulled it over and put it alongside his. Well, to make a long story short, what had happened, he had actually hired a rather accomplished makeup artist, costume engineer from Hollywood to fabricate a convincing set of footprints. And this would-be hoaxer had utilized the Hereford track as his model.
Wow.
And those little details, you know, jumped out at me like like neon signs. And
so wait, Les Stroud tried to hoax you?
Yeah, he did. The rascal.
That's hilarious.
But anyway.
So I feel like this is my theory. I grew up in the West. I grew up in the desert, so there's no Sasquatch in the part of the desert that I grew up in. But there's been some compelling evidence in northern Arizona. But it feels like, I guess my theory is, the best evidence and the most credible evidence has to be in the Pacific Northwest, because it feels as though something like this could not really survive in the East, even though there's a lot of forest and trees. You know, being from Kentucky, there's, you know, if I want to hunt in Kentucky, I got to know somebody whose land I can sit in a tree on versus tracking, because there's just almost no hunting ground that's not possessed by someone. It seems much more difficult for an animal like this or a being like this to survive, even though there's so many sightings. I feel like I want to just assign anything on the East Coast to imagination, and anything on the West Coast I want to take a closer look at. Is that the wrong hypothesis?
Well, I wouldn't be that I wouldn't go that quite that far. I mean, for a long time I just kind of limited myself to the West because I didn't have that much time to devote to these to this topic, and that was sort of a bit of a cop out, I must admit. My rule of thumb right now is sort of my working hypothesis is that if a black bear population can make a living, you know, because they have similar, and there's actually been very interesting data put forward. There was a paper that was done. One of the authors was a friend of mine who does GIS research, geographic information systems. He and a couple of his colleagues were writing an editorial reviewing some software packages that are used to model ecological parameters of various species and so on. And they were cautioning the users of these packages that you got to know what the black box is doing. You can't just crunch the numbers. And so to demonstrate the potential pitfalls, they sort of tongue-in-cheek used what was ostensibly bogus data to see what the result would be. Well, the bogus data they decided to use was Sasquatch databases. Mm-hmm. and so they crunched the numbers, and out comes remarkably coherent patterns and correlations with ecological climatic variables.
Meaning and that where people were citing them, they could live for the most part.
Right.
Wow.
And it lined up uncannily parallel to those same parameters for black bear populations.
Okay, wouldn't the hypothesis by some skeptics then be, well, what they're seeing is black bears standing on their feet?
That's right, and that's exactly what they said in the article.
Okay,
and knowing one of these authors, I contacted him and chided him a bit, and I said, hey, what's going on here? Why are you? I know. Have you switched sides? Because I knew of his interest. I mean, he actually did his senior thesis as an undergraduate at the University of Colorado on geospatial analyses of Sasquatch data, and had some really interesting results and got a very high mark on his paper. Anyway, and he said, Jeff, you more than anyone should appreciate that had we even suggested the possibility that we were giving serious consideration to this data, the paper never would have been published.
Wow.
So we had to sort of adopt a tongue-in-cheek approach and make these caveats to satisfy the reviewers of the paper.
Right.
But, he said, I'll have you know that my co-authors who entered into the project, very skeptical of the possibility of Sasquatch, after seeing the results, are very interested. He said, I've got them reading your book now. And so so the point being, the take-home message is, however, that if this outcome is reliable, then it does indicate that there is indeed remarkable similarity, as you might expect, for two large omnivores to have similar habitat requirements. Now, that doesn't mean that they're mutually competitive, because there are very different adaptations expressed by either one. They could be usually utilizing different resources in similar habitats.
You know?
I mean, the Sasquatch presumably has much heavier jaws and thick, enormous, thickly enameled molars and premolars that allow it to chew and grind things that would be, you know, unaccessible to a black bear.
Right.
They probably have a gut physiology of a primate that allows them to digest and detoxify, you know, slow gut passage time of a frugivore that is very different from a bear that has evolved from a carnivore ancestor,
right,
and so on. So taking that now and going back to your original question, West versus East, you know, what's the bear population in your neck of the woods?
Yeah,
you know,
fence
lines and no trespassing signs keep people out, but they don't keep the animals out.
Right.
And so those are artificial boundaries. So as long as there's, and in fact, since the landowners aren't traipsing over every square inch of the land they own, probably, that may actually even limit, you know, human introgression or trespass into those areas. So,
yeah.
But when you compare the available habitat, you know, the numbers. I did a presentation out there in Georgia not too long ago, and I had a table, and I can't remember the actual numbers. But I mean, for example, in a given southern state, there might be between 1,000 and 5,000. Black bear,
right,
in the whole state. Or, you know, there are some states there, I think it was North Carolina, has no resident population, North and South Carolina. But Idaho, by contrast, has 35,000
right.
black bear.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
British Columbia has 115,000 black bear.
This is almost as many people as they have if you take Vancouver
out.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah. You know, then you have to question, well, when they're seeing Bigfoot all the time in some of these eastern states, what are they actually seeing? And what you find is there's a plethora on the online, a lot of the online reports that are not your quote class A, as BFRO uses. They're not visual encounters. They're bumps in the night, or they're tipped over trees, or mm-hmm. bent, you know, branches or structures, quote unquote structures. They're, you know, something left a handprint on the window that doesn't show up until you've driven into camp and the dust sticks to it. That's the funniest thing, you know. When people get up the next morning and they find this handprint on the back window of their hatchback,
right,
and it's and all the dust is stuck to the grease. Well, you know, when you drove in on that dirty road and coated the car with dust, if someone leaves a handprint, it's going to be a negative. It's going to lift
right.
dust away.
Right.
It's the person who closed the hatchback in the driveway, leaving a greasy handprint, which then the dust differentially sticks to.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, on the drive out. So, I mean, there are some that are interesting. I don't mean to say,
right.
but I mean, there's just, you have to. Who was it? I just went blank on his name. I can see his face. You have to wear your skepticals.
Right.
You have to be critical about a lot of this stuff, because people have expectations. I mean, this is the age old problem of eyewitness encounters.
Right.
And
one of the most, and I don't remember, I can't remember if you were involved in this or not. I actually made my wife watch this. It was an episode of a TV show about cryptids, and it was, I can't remember if you were involved, but it was a case where they brought in a couple of scientists, and it was a guy who owned a piece of property and a cabin up on a lake way up in central Canada. And there had been this legend that there was some sort of beast there. And these scientists came in, they set up, tell me if you were one of them, but they set up, and during the, they actually had a situation where something was throwing rocks at the cabin. They threw it back, and it threw back again. And I'm like, there's no animal I know of that throws rocks at people. And I'm like, they're 1,000 miles from anyone.
Yeah.
That was pretty compelling.
It was. Yeah, I was. That was at Snell Grove Lake.
Yes, in, yes. You were in that.
In Ontario.
Yes.
Okay. I was in that.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
So you
and
were
that
there.
Wasn't interesting. Yeah, I was there. I was there when the rock, I'd gone in to, I mean, we would try to stay up late, and I have to admit I'm not a night owl. I have trouble staying up and staying alert. And I was getting pretty punchy. So I went into the cabin to splash some water in my face, and the son of the producer was relieving himself, taking a leak off of the porch because the outhouse was back, 50 yards behind the cabin down a catwalk.
Yeah, who wants to go out there in the middle of the night when there's a Sasquatch?
Right. And so the cabin is, the sides of the cabin are all covered with corrugated steel siding, and boom, or this whack. The sound of a rock. It was almost like a 22 shot, just thwacked against the siding, which I could hear very clearly from inside the house, and it was very close to where this young man was standing, and scared the daylights out of him. He ran back to the campfire, hiking his pants up as he went, and so I came out, and they were all chattering about it, and did you hear it? And I said, well, of course, yeah, I heard it. I said, which one, and then just to test the waters, I said, so which one of you threw it? Just to see what the reaction would be. And, oh, no, it came from the way over there, and it was the opposite direction from where the campfire was, where the fire pit,
right
out towards the lake. And anyway, that's when Kurt Nelson picked up a rock and said, well, I'm gonna throw it back in that direction. And I jokingly, half jokingly, said, don't throw anything too big, he might pick it up and throw it right back at you. So he threw, it was about a golf ball sized rock, I guess, and he threw that, and you could hear it thump off of the tree trunks and in the darkness, and nothing happened. And so our attention kind of laxed, and I was on the far side of the fire pit, so I was facing towards the cabin. And there was something, I think there was a noise. I'm trying to remember exactly whether it was a noise or whether it was just the movement out of the corner of my eye. And I looked up, and arcing towards the roof of the cabin was this rock. It wasn't coming from the exact spot where it had been, where he had thrown, but it was over to the right, to the opposite side. Anyway, but it arced and landed on this metal roof of the cabin, and bounced with good report across and rolled down the gutter and stopped there near the edge. And
wow.
The group just, like a little bevy of peahens, went in a line, zoomed into the cabin and disappeared, leaving me. I'm standing there saying, hey, where are you going? This is why. Well, they said they were after their camera.
You used to go get the camera in the middle of the night. Excuse. How'd you sleep that night?
It was quite fun. Well, that was what was interesting, because this actually got edited from, just for the sake of time, cut from the final. Eventually, we were out there. I mean, they got the cameras, and it was a bit unfortunate because, the producer, Doug Hajcik, wanted to immediately capture Kurt and my reactions. And so they start filming us right there in the cabin before we went immediately back out. And that's when Kurt made this remark, just out of emotion. He goes, here we are, huddled in the cabin. I got so much mail. You wouldn't believe how much mail. What are you doing huddled in the cabin? Why aren't you outside? Why aren't you? And I, because it didn't really portray what actually happened, that I was the last one out there.
Right.
And to make a long story short, we scouted out. Went into the woods, into the darkness. We did have an early version of a thermal imager. This was early on before FLIR was available, and we had some night vision and so on. And but it was just it was pitch black,
right.
And It's kind of treacherous to go traipsing around out there because there's so many crevices, and I mean, you're on that Canadian Shield, and so it's a lot of granite, a lot of faults and cracks and crevices, and a lot of moss and
right.
and low vegetation, and one false step, and you could drop into a 3-foot crevice or deeper
wow.
and break a leg, you know. And so we
but
were kind of
certain there was no one around you, no other human beings.
That... No, I was certain. I mean,
right.
the only way in and out, to the best of my knowledge, was by float plane.
Yeah,
and this was the fifth day in there. There were people who criticized. They said, you know, you could go on Google Earth, and there was a village just a few, you know, I don't know how many miles off to the east, and you know, there was a road. I mean, there was. I don't believe there was a road because
right.
You couldn't walk more than a quarter of a mile in any direction before you would be in a lake.
Right.
I mean, when you fly over that country there, you look down, more of it's water than land.
Right.
And there is no, you know, straight shot from point A to point B. You know, to get from point A to point B, which is maybe 3 miles off, you'd have to walk 15
right.
to get there.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I was very, very, you know, found it very dubious that
people
there were,
living in that area aren't concerned about somebody staying at a cabin and saying, let's walk
well, right.
15 miles in the middle of the night to throw a rock at them.
Exactly. Oh, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Well, then, see, then what happened, what even got more exciting, we eventually did go to bed.
Okay.
And we said, okay, we're going to, you know, kind of, quote, keep our boots on, and we're just going to stretch out and close our eyes. And I'm not kidding. No sooner had the lights gone off and my lids were just drooping down than kabang, something landed on the roof. And whatever had thrown the rock now apparently had thrown a chunk of cordwood from the woodpile out back
wow.
onto the roof. And,
wow.
and man, I mean, it really resounded. Dwayne, the son, sat up screaming. The lights go on, and I said, "No, turn the lights off so we can see out through." Because as soon as you turn
right.
the lights on, the windows are all like mirrors, and you can't see out, see anything. And so, anyway, then I was a little less anxious to go running out in the
yeah.
woods if it was raining cordwood, you know.
Right.
And so,
right.
But we didn't catch a glimpse of anything. We didn't find there was nothing, no way to find sign.
Right.
You know, it was out by the cordwood was, you know, 3 inches of sawdust and stuff. And out in the woods, the ground is like walking on a foam mattress.
So what do you think is the best way to see one of these?
Well, the vast majority of encounters occur along water or on a road.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, I mean, that means people, you know, and along water takes in a lot of the backcountry roads and trails
right.
because they tend to follow water courses and the roads are where people are covering more area and are more likely to see wildlife crossing the roads.
Right.
So, but the vast majority are absolutely by happenstance.
Right.
And so, you know, I've been out there trying to have an encounter for how many years, and I've maybe caught a glimpse of something once.
Right.
In 28.
Do you think the Patterson-Gimlin film is real?
I do.
Okay.
I'm absolutely convinced. I mean, I'm as convinced as I can be short of having stood there on the sandbar myself and witnessing it.
I don't want to keep you too long. I feel like I'm rude if I keep going, but I want to talk about your book before we wrap up, but on the Patterson-Gimlin film, what is it about that you, as an anatomist, that you look at and
right.
say, that is not, first of all, it was early on in all of this, and I don't think there was a lot of people
yeah.
running around looking for a gorilla suit, and they weren't very advanced at that time either. But
no.
what is it about that you say, that's a real creature?
Right. Well, on one level, again, as I mentioned earlier, that the footprints are by far the most compelling evidence for me. And so if all I had were the footprints, the documented footprints associated with that film, I would be convinced that it was real.
Okay.
That the evidence of the mid-tarsal break, the midfoot flexibility, the proportionality, et cetera, all these things, these aspects of the Patterson-Gimlin film Trackway are extremely compelling. But then having, in addition to that, the track maker, where you can watch the kinematics of the foot that left those footprints, see the dynamic action, and then all that goes with it. You know, what's interesting with 2020 hindsight, well, nearly 2020 hindsight, we don't have all the answers yet, but we've learned a lot since 1967 about human evolution and hominin evolution. And there are so many aspects of that film which at the time were would cut against the grain of conventional wisdom mm-hmm. in the science. And that was essentially why you got the reaction. It can't exist, therefore it doesn't exist. By it right. can't exist, it wasn't just an attitude that there can't be monsters, there can't be mythical beings. The attitude was the prevailing paradigm of the pattern of human evolution was labeled the single species hypothesis, that you can only have one species in any given niche, and therefore the hominin niche, a bipedal, upright walking, you know, tool using or culture bearing hominin, there can be only one species occupying it, yeah. occupying that niche. And so evolution was seen as a single file. There can be only one. Well, one already exists. That's us. Therefore, there can't be another bipedal hominin walking around in Northern California. Therefore, it doesn't. It must be a hoax. Right. So how are we going to identify this as a hoax? Well, it was interesting. Napier, if you indulge me in this short story, sure. Napier was one of the more open-minded of those who viewed the film at that time. He went on, in fact, to write a book about Sasquatch and Yeti. And it was a pretty darn good book for its time. There are some problems and issues I take with some of his conclusions now, based on what we know. But one of the only thing he could put his finger on that falsified, other than the general attitude that there can't be such a species, is he said, "I look at it, and from the waist up, it essentially looks like an ape, and from the waist down, it looks typically human in proportion." He said, "It's nearly inconceivable. I can't conceive of such a hybrid of structure existing naturally, existing in nature." And so one or the other must be hoaxed. Therefore, they're all hoaxed. You know, the whole thing is a hoax. Well, it's interesting because his book came out in 1973. In 1974, the skeleton of Lucy was discovered, which was, you know, the first time we had about 40% of an Australopithecine skeleton.
Right.
And isn't it interesting? And for the first time, really had a good notion about their bipedal anatomy.
Wow.
Especially the knee and the pelvis and so on. And isn't it interesting? In the popular press, they were saying, yeah, from the waist up, she looks like a chimpanzee, but from the waist down, she looks like a human. Isn't it interesting how evolution has proceeded in such a mosaic fashion? Well, now, wait a minute. And those pronouncements, you know, were in the popular press. The final analyses were several years later. But, I mean, even that's even more compelling because, first, the very linchpin to Napier's counter-argument was wrong.
Right.
I mean, that combination wasn't inconceivable. It might have been inconceivable in 1967, but it wasn't inconceivable in 1974.
Right.
And so time and time again, the Patterson-Gimlin film actually anticipates in the odd things, you know, a foot with a flexible instep and a non-divergent big toe. What a weird combination. Or a flat face but lacking projecting, a flat face lacking projecting canines, but in the absence of tool use, which was thought to be the selection pressure for the reduction of the snout and the huge canine teeth. See,
yeah,
and a small brain and a more modern bipedal posture, you know, which was unexpected.
Because which they of, couldn't, you know, even going they, back. They wouldn't have forethought that in a hoax in 1967.
No, and especially not a ne'er-do-well rodeo rider, jack-of-all-trades Roger Patterson,
right.
whose character is always being assassinated. you know, and Bob Gimlin wouldn't have a clue about those kinds of issues in, you know, things that were debated for decades in anthropology.
Right.
You know, and even if they had an expert in the wings, why would he incorporate things that were absolutely, if you wanted to make a convincing hoax,
they were
things
unknown
that
at the
were
time.
Absolutely counter, yeah.
Yeah.
So it's just
Initial reaction too to Napier's theory is, isn't that the point of a Sasquatch? That it's a hybrid, that it's neither one or the other. So when you say,
well, yes.
You know, when you say, well, he looks kind of like he got a human. Well, that's the whole point. He's a bipedal ape something.
Well, sure. So I would rather say intermediate. Because
right, okay.
Hybrid is such a loaded term in so many people's minds today. I mean, the notion that Sasquatch is the spawn of a cross between a human and a pre-human
right.
is just ludicrous. But,
right, right.
But anyway, but intermediate, yeah. I mean, we have variation, and again, the hominin fossil record shows this.
Yeah.
Just a myriad of unexpected combinations of primitive and derived traits.
Yeah.
The one that's getting all the headlines now, Homo naledi, that it existed right up to, about 200 to 300,000 years ago. So it was around when Homo sapiens came on the scene, and this creature had some modernish characteristics, say of its foot and ankle, it still had other characteristics of its skeleton that were very primitive for an Australopithecine.
Yeah.
So I mean, you know, you had this bipedal chimpanzee-like creature walking around at the same time that there was modern Homo sapiens 200,000 years ago.
That's fascinating.
So it's just there's just so many interesting things to say. It can't exist is just so inanely ignorant,
right?
That I would be, if I'm the one who uttered that, I'd be, you know, hugely embarrassed and ashamed to take responsibility.
I just hope when we finally do find it, that somebody doesn't shoot it. I hope that there's something beautiful about the fact that there may be a creature living in the wild. In the most free way that you can possibly imagine, I almost don't want to find it because I'm like,
right.
He's managed to avoid the pitfalls of humanity for all these years.
Right.
Let's leave him alone, you know?
Yeah, I know. I wrestle with some of those same ethical issues myself, philosophical issues myself. I mean, on the one hand, as a scientist and one who has expended, committed significant part of my career and reputation on the question, I certainly would love to see it resolved. But and the other point is too, you know, to exemplify what I'm about to say, let me just give you a little background. At one point, when I was writing my book and I was including perspectives from the Native American population, I wanted their blessing, their nod of approval that I was on the mark. And I had an audience before the tribal council here in at Fort Hall at the Shoshone-Bannock Tribal Council Hall. And at one point, I mean, it was very interesting to me, the story in and of it, long story in and of itself. But at one point, the council president said to me, "You people," you know, referring to my where I come from, I guess,
right.
"You people, you mess things up and then you want to study them." He said, you always mess things up and then you want to study it. And I said, well, I have to acknowledge and agree with you that a lot of things have gone poorly in the past and things have been messed up. But I said, do you think that was the result of a position or actions resulting from understanding or ignorance? And I said, I'm here to try to gain some understanding and share what little I have with you, but hopefully receive understanding. And so, you know, he seemed to appreciate that.
Right.
And so, you know, there is an argument to be made that in order to be good stewards, we can't just ignore it and let things go as they may. But, you know, you to really take responsibility and for something and be a good steward, you have to understand it,
yeah,
and have to appreciate it. So, so for that reason, I hope it isn't resolved. I mean, that's why by the lethal collection of a type specimen, I hope that we can get some definitive DNA or tissue sample or something, or someone stumbles on a jaw or tooth or something like that to help or to bring it to a resolution.
Yeah. Well, gosh, this has been one of the most fascinating discussions. I honestly can tell you right now it's going to go down as one of my favorite episodes of the podcast. And I could talk for hours. Hopefully you'll come on with us again sometime. But I want to just let people know that your book is pretty amazing too. Sasquatch, Legend Meets Science. And if you're looking for someone with credibility, someone with academic credentials who is putting this together in an objective way, I would say if you're an open-minded skeptic, read this book, because it's not the stuff you see on TV that's chasing down, you know, every rumor and thing. You're chasing science, and it's pretty fascinating. I highly recommend it. You can get it on Amazon as well. So
great. Yeah. Thanks. Well, I appreciate that very much, and I'd be delighted to come back and chat.
Awesome.
It doesn't take much to get me going, and then it's hard to get me to stop.
No, I love it. That's what I love about podcasts too, is we don't have to worry about commercial breaks, you know? So we can just, we can go on and really get the understanding. You were talking about understanding, people understanding the science behind it. That's good. Listen, Dr. Meldrum, thank you so much. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right. Have a great day. Honestly, that's going to go down as one of my favorite episodes ever. Just fascinating. And I love that he was in that story that I heard about on the Snowgrave Lake. That's amazing. Listen, if you love what we're doing here at the podcast, please share it with your friends. It's free download, man. Totally free at Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and on iHeartRadio. Just search The Disruption Zone, and it'll go right to your phone. I love that. Thanks to JP Web Design and Dynamics Productions for their help with the audio of this program and the website of this program. Thanks to my co-host and co-executive producer, Cameron Mills. Wish he could have been here for this one. That would have been fun. But he'll be back with us soon. And thank you. Thank you for listening. Please share this podcast as widely as possible. It's helping us grow. I love it that we're getting thousands of downloads a week. We really appreciate it. So that's it for me. Follow me on Twitter at Leland Show and at Zone Disruption, and on Instagram at Greatly Londo and at The Disruption Zone. Thanks for listening to The Disruption Zone.